this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. My name is Patsy Gill. My guest is Matthew Palmer, who has written a thriller about the conflict between India and Pakistan over Kashmir. Since he actually works for the U.S. Foreign Service, he is in a position to know more about international intrigue than the average writer. His new book, Secrets of State, is very exciting, and I'm so happy to have him on the program today. Matthew, or which do you prefer, Matthew or Matt?
Either one. They both work for me.
Okay, my son has gone through that phase. He was Danny, then he was Daniel for years, and you couldn't change it. And now he's back. He's Dan, and so he gets so tight if we change it. So now I always ask people who have these names that could be either way, which they prefer.
So I actually can go. I have no preference.
You don't have okay. Maybe when you get a little older, one doesn't care as much. As long as
I hope I have the opportunity to get a little older.
Oh, as long as one knows that your author name, Matthew Palmer, is what they have to look for when they get to Amazon, and that's the important thing. So I'll call you Matt if that's okay.
That's fine.
Okay. Well, this is so exciting because I love your book. And I was really...
I'm glad.
They always talk, when a new thriller comes out, they'll say, it's an international, thriller, and it's exciting and all of that, and it's torn from the headlines. But in your case, it's not actually torn from the headlines, because unfortunately, this whole conflict of over Kashmir is almost not known, to most of the people, and yet it is so important. And as I, it's the hot spot of the world. And once President Clinton described it as the most dangerous place on earth.
Correct.
So it's so great. I love books where you learn as you read without actually, it's not a lesson. It's not a school book, but your book is so full of interesting stories and interesting ideas that it really opens a person's mind up, and that's why I really enjoy it. It is also a nonstop page turner. So tell me, were you ever you are an active member of the U.S. Foreign Service, correct?
That's correct.
And were you ever stationed in Kashmir?
I have never actually been stationed there. I worked on South Asia out of the U.S. mission to the United Nations some years ago, but I picked that place and that conflict less because I have a deep base of personal experience and more because I think it's a fascinating, intriguing, and threatening situation, and one that is ripe for exposition in a novel, that lends itself well to drama and tension.
Well, it does, and I had shades of the China syndrome as I was reading it. Something comes out about a subject, and then the actual event happens, and so it was like a little scary. At one point, I put the book down. Actually, I walked away from it. I said, "Oh wow, this is too much." I'm like in overload. But then I ran back to it.
I'm pleased. Part of what I'm trying to do is to help people understand a little bit more about the world and the way the world works. But the other thing that I'd like to do with these books, and one of the reasons why I'm writing them, is to give people a better understanding about the nature of diplomacy as a profession and the U.S. Foreign Service as an institution. There's a lot of thrillers out there that feature as their protagonists spies or soldiers, and I think the American public has reason to believe that they kind of understand what it is that those people do. But diplomats, to the extent we feature at all in popular culture, are marginal characters usually doing something amoral and snaky on the side that puts the actual hero in danger. And I wanted my colleagues to be the hero. I wanted to put the diplomats front and center and explain what it is that we do.
Well, you've done that with the Secrets of State, and your hero, you know, Sam Traynor, the beautiful thing about it is he is not a superhero. He's an average guy who stumbles onto a dangerous secret. Tell us a little bit about Sam and the background of how he got involved in this whole intriguing, thriller.
Sure. Sam is a little bit north of 50, recently and involuntarily retired from the State Department. The Foreign Service is like the military in its personnel system. We are up or out, meaning that you have a certain number of years to get promoted from one level to the next, and then a number of years to get from that level to the one above that. And if you don't make it, if you miss a rung, if you fail to make it to the next level in the time allotted, you are retired involuntarily. It's called ticked out, time in class. So Sam has been ticked out of the Foreign Service and has gotten a job working for what we call a beltway bandit, which is a consultancy that has only one client, the U.S. government. And these institutions ring our nation's capital like a moat, almost. And this company, Argus Systems, has a contract to provide intelligence and analysis on South Asia. And Sam is a South Asia expert of some repute. And he is sitting at his desk, and in his intel take, he comes across a product, a piece of intelligence that he knows has been fabricated. He knows it's been fabricated because it's an intercept of a conversation between a senior official in New Delhi and the Indian political counselor at the embassy in Washington. But according to the date-time group on that product, she couldn't have been part of that conversation. She was with Sam in a cabin in the Shenandoah that had no landline and no cell reception because they're having an affair. She's married. He's got a security clearance. They can't tell anyone about it. But on the theory that if you see a cockroach on the kitchen floor, there's 1,000 in the walls, Sam goes looking and he finds a whole raft of intelligence that has been fabricated and that is pushing India and Pakistan closer to nuclear war. And the question in the novel is, who in their right mind would want to do that?
And that is the question that, you know, when I started reading it, I said, oh my gosh, this is crazy. And then the further I got into it, I thought, yeah, well, the world is crazy at this time, you know, so it's there. And I love that, you know, Sam is, goes out on this adventure in a way to save the world. But along the way, you know, you've made him so interesting. You've accomplished what every writer hopes, that you have a character that people really care about. And of course, I love his daughter. This introduction of his daughter as a main character, you know, sometimes it doesn't always work out as well as you've done it. You've made her so real, so interesting, and you've captured sort of the essence of her dilemma of being caught between two worlds. Explain that, how this, she's a half American, half Indian woman, and not just that, she's a Dalit. And explain how came out with that idea.
Sure. Caste is kind of a rough analog for race in the United States, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the Indian caste system. And Sam's former wife, he's actually a widower, had been a Dalit, what many Americans may know as the Untouchables. They're sort of out of the caste system, but at the sort of bottom end of the social hierarchy in the Indian system. And I wanted to give Lena this status, an outsider status. She's half American, she's half Indian. The half that's Indian is Dalit. She's exploring her roots. The roots of her mother's experience, her mother's family. And so she's back in Mumbai at the beginning of the novel, working in the slum where her mother grew up, in Dahravi, the big slum in Mumbai that was featured in Slumdog Millionaire. And even as she understands that that she can never truly be a part of that world because she can leave at any time, that she always has the option of going back to the United States, and the people in the slum don't have that option. They are born there, they are trapped there, there is no getting out for them. So it puts her in a very different position. She wants in, she wants to be a part of that world, but at the same time she knows she never can. I do not believe in damsels in distress. In too much of thriller fiction, the female characters are there to get in trouble so that the guys can save them. And that is not what Lena is.
Lena is not at all.
She's going to take charge of her own fate.
And her strength.
And I tell one story about when Lena was small, when she was a little kid, a little girl, and she had built a little fort out of couch cushions and was dressed up as a princess, and her father saw what she was doing and said, you know, my girl is not a helpless princess waiting for the handsome prince to come and rescue her from the tower. You can play princess if you want, but wear a sword with your tiara.
I thought that was a wonderful story, and it really encompasses what she is. And I think she's, you know, we had recently here in Tampa, we had the Bollywood Film Festival, and it was very exciting. I'm involved in the film community here, and so I got to meet, you know, some of the actors and the actresses. And as I'm reading, you know, your book, I keep in mind, I was always thinking, oh, which actress is going to play her? Because it is such a beautiful role for an actress. And I'm sure that when you do a movie deal, it's going to be exciting for you to see who they pick to play her, because it's going to be a great role.
Every author looks forward to that day. Even the ones who would tell you they don't think about it, they've all mentally cast their own film.
Well, yeah, I'm sure you have. And because in your case, it's so, the dialogue and everything moves so quickly. There, you know, at the end, I'm like, I can't stop reading this book. I can't put it down. I forget the housework, forget everything else. I had to read it because it just moved. It flowed so beautifully. As I was reading, I was thinking of a great Indian movie about the Dalits. Have you ever seen that movie, Rajneeti?
Yes.
Isn't that a wonderful movie?
It is a fabulous movie,
and it really explains what it means to be a Dalit, and so I kept thinking about that movie as I was reading the book.
It's something that's very hard for Americans, I think, to understand.
Oh, absolutely.
That, you know, we understand race and we understand the way that can impact your life, but caste for us is such an abstraction. That I think it's very hard to get our minds wrapped around, and therefore I think makes for something very interesting as an element in a story.
Well, I think that's exactly what you did. You opened up. I think you'll open up people's eyes to what it means, and that's the beauty of how you wrote it. I thought that part was absolutely amazing. Now, one of the parts that was absolutely horrifying, and I don't know. I think that's where, at the point where I put the book down and I said, I can't take this anymore. I just can't take this. And that's where you were talking about how much, and I'm not sure, is it real? I have to, that's why I wanted to talk to you. How much of government work is contracted out? I mean, serious things, real secrets. Is this true? I mean, it was scary to read about it.
Well, you know, Dwight Eisenhower, on his way out the door at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, famously and presciently warned the American public about the dangers of the military-industrial complex. And now, I would argue, we're faced with something parallel, a parallel challenge that you could call the security-industrial complex. And the roots of this really are well-meaning. It's to promote the kinds of efficiencies that you get in the private sector by outsourcing. But it's one thing if you're outsourcing the Pentagon shuttle bus or the NSA cafeteria, and quite another if you're outsourcing core national security functions. We're at a point where the Pentagon could not fight wars and the State Department could not keep its diplomats in difficult and dangerous places without private companies. doing a lot of the heavy lifting. And that is a vulnerability, I think, that we should all be concerned about.
And they're not under the same, well, not just obligations, but they're not under the same, okay, patriotic motivations as
the motives, you know, are different. And I'm not talking about individual contractors, but talking about contracting as an abstraction, and contractors as companies, rather
because
than
it's always
people.
About the bottom line in that case. You know,
it's about the bottom line. It is about profit, and national security should not be about profit.
It's like people are going to read your book and they're going to say, okay, let's have a little bit of a congressional hearing about this. Just how much of that
would be good for me, actually.
When I put the book down and I'm thinking, I can't take this. I mean, I want to call my congressman. I want to call somebody and say, you can't do this. You can't hand out all this information to people who have no obligation, you know, other than, you know, might have a moral obligation, you know, but they'll just, for money, they'll just release this information. It's too frightening.
After 9/11, there were competing pressures that were placed on the United States government. One was to do everything possible, always more and more, to protect the American people in an increasingly dangerous world. And the other was to shrink, right? To get small, to deal with the fiscal pressures, to get small enough that Grover Norquist could drown government in a bathtub. And you can't do these two things at the same time. You can't square that circle unless you use contractors, because they do the work and they don't count. It doesn't look like government has grown. There aren't any more federal employees. But someone's got to do this work. Who's doing it? Now it's private contractors who work for private companies, some of which are publicly traded, some of which are privately held, but all of which are interested in making a buck.
And all of you Foreign Service personnel are now faced with such dangers that, you know, I'm sure when you got into it 25 years ago, it had a much more romantic appeal, you know, travel, live in places and do, you know, good for America. But nowadays, it must be pretty frightening to take some of these assignments.
It still has that appeal, but, you know, this work has always been dangerous. There is, if you walk into the main lobby of the State Department, the C Street lobby, on both walls is a marble memorial to those who have lost their lives in the line of duty, and there are a lot of names on that wall. It is a dangerous profession. Living overseas, representing the United States, sometimes you're going to be the deliberate target of violence. I lost friends and colleagues in the bombings in East Africa. Sometimes it's going to be just a function of the dangers of living overseas. I've lost colleagues to drowning from swimming off a beach with a bad current, or from driving. Driving in some of these countries is one of the more dangerous things that we're ever going to do. Sometimes it's from disease. You can get some pretty bad parasites in some of our places in Africa. And then sometimes it's going to be from terrorist action in a place like Iraq or Afghanistan.
Well, you know, I think perhaps people are appreciating the work that you're doing a little bit more in recent years when they have realized how dangerous it is. Now, as an active person with the Foreign Service, your work has to be vetted by them, right?
Oh, absolutely, yes. For my manuscripts, I have to submit for clearance. They're not looking for really what it is that I'm saying. They're looking for classified information. They're looking for whether I am revealing anything, sources or methods or anything classified that I shouldn't be talking about. And this is fiction, so I really don't have much trouble with it. And to the extent that they do find some things that they'd like me to change, it's easy enough to make those changes. It's much harder, I think, for them to vet nonfiction or memoirs or stuff that's historical in nature than fiction is pretty straightforward.
Well, I think it's, you know, the possibility of a nuclear conflict between India, Pakistan, you know, is there. You know, most Americans don't know anything about Kashmir. Actually, most Americans, I think if you said Kashmir, they'll think of Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, I noticed you played a Led Zeppelin song.
Exactly. Well, you know, that's Kashmir, which it's funny if people listen to that and think that's Kashmir. Although I love the sound, you know, it's got a nice,
it's a great tune.
It's a great tune. But of course, do you know, realize that they wrote that in Northern Africa?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they were not in Kashmir, but of course they were probably so stoned out of their mind, they didn't know where they were anyway. It's still a great song. So it does have that sort of that beat that makes you think of Kashmir. But you know, some of the words they say: "The secret elders of the gentle race. This world is seldom seen. They talk of days."
Yeah, I think they've been reading a lot of Tolkien.
Exactly, I think so, because it's not it's. The conflict has been so long. It's been like, well, I mean, it's not a peaceful place. It hasn't been for a long time.
No, we forget, you know, kind of what the history of this is. This all comes from the dissolution of the British Raj, Pakistan being separated from India, and then Bangladesh being separated from Pakistan, and millions of people lost their lives. Millions of people were displaced from their homes. Tens of millions of people were displaced. There was a forced relocation of huge populations. And when you're talking about places like India and Pakistan, you very quickly start to get into very big numbers in terms of how many people are involved or affected by something. And India and Pakistan have fought several wars triggered by tension in Kashmir over the last couple of decades. And that means one thing when they're big conventional powers, and quite another when they're nuclear powers.
Well, I think the premise of your story and the entire, you know, idea is great. It's very exciting, and you know, I think the Indians and the Pakistanis have to perhaps start worrying about the Chinese, who have their own claim to Kashmir. So it's another reason it's such a dangerous place in the world.
The Chinese do have a border dispute with India, but not in Kashmir. It's up in the Himalayas.
Yeah, a little further north. I want to continue in a minute. I have to take a short break, and we'll be right back. And this is WTAN 1340, Tampa Bay's Tantalk Radio Network, broadcasting out of beautiful Clearwater, Florida. I'll be right back.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
Are you looking for the perfect gift? Going to a wedding? A special birthday? The Silver Queen is the place to go. Don't settle for the ordinary. At the Silver Queen, you will find a unique gift. Things that you won't find at the mall. From beautiful photo frames to silver and china. Guys, looking for that perfect ring? You'll find it at the Silver Queen. And don't forget their bridal registry. Located at 1350 West Bay Drive in Largo. Visit their website, silverqueen.com. They have some wonderful coupons. And when you go to the store, tell them that Patsy with a Z sent you.
At the Oaks of Clearwater, you'll enjoy a lifestyle to fit your needs. From independent living, assisted living, memory care, and skilled nursing. Our exciting independent lifestyle is the perfect combination of freedom, comfort, and security. Enjoy total independence with peace of mind. Our independent lifestyle includes chef-prepared meals in our beautiful waterfront dining room, a continental breakfast, all utilities, including cable and telephone, housekeeping with linen service, service, scheduled transportation, including trips for shopping, local restaurants, theater, and more. Our activities program is second to none. At the Oaks of Clearwater, you'll enjoy affordable luxury waterfront senior living with a $1 million view. Call today, 727-445-4069. And discover where caring, compassionate service really makes the difference.
Arg, matey. When it's time for lunch, when it's time for dinner, when the show's over, when the day's over, when it's time to chill, where do we go? Over to Naughty Nancy's Food Shack and Crow's Nest Pub. It's literally in our backyard, right in back of the WTAN studios at 700 Eldridge Street, just north of downtown Clearwater. Just look for the broadcast tower. Nancy's food and atmosphere get rave reviews. The laid-back patio is a great place to hang out, dine, and listen to live music at night. And Nancy's one of the friendliest proprietors in town. And now, Nancy is serving Sunday Jazz Brunch from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Brunch served with Eggs Benedict, crepes, waffles, lox and bagels, shrimp, oysters, and a build-your-own omelet. That's all at Naughty Nancy's Food Shack and Crow's Nest Pub, 700 Eldridge Street in Clearwater. That's right where Eldridge crosses the Pinellas Trail between Myrtle and Fort Harrison. Call 446-3717. 446-3717. You're listening to the Tan Talk Radio Network.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I'm back with my guest, Matthew Palmer. Matt, tell me, you know, I usually ask authors which writer most influenced them. But in your case, I think I know.
Oh, yes, you do. You're absolutely right.
So tell us about your dad.
My father, Michael Palmer, was a thriller writer. He wrote medical thrillers. Had a very successful career. He wrote 20 books, most of them on the New York Times list. My brother is also a thriller writer. He writes psychological thrillers, and in fact, his latest, Constant Fear, came out on the exact same day as Secrets of State.
I mean, did you plan that? You.
A little bit. I asked my publisher to move my publication date up a couple of weeks to come in line with his, so that we could do some book events together.
Oh, that's nice. That's
and in
sweet.
In fact, we've gotten to do a little bit of publicity. We've gotten to do some public events, some talks as brothers, kind of like click and clack on cars.
I love click and clack. Them.
And it's been great fun to do, but it was our father that taught us how to write books. So even though we all write in very different genres, Pop in medical thrillers, my brother in psychological stuff, and myself in diplomatic political thrillers, there are some commonalities to what we do that I think are actually quite interesting. You know, we talked a little bit about Sam Trainor as being just a regular guy, not a super spy. And this comes from our dad. That what he taught us was you want to create a sense of tension for your readers that will keep them turning the page. And the best and easiest way to do that is to take a regular person and put them in extraordinary circumstances. And if your readers care about them, they will care what happens to them, and they'll keep turning the pages to find out. And so that's one of the reasons why I don't have a recurring character. It's because that's what we learned from our father. Regular people, incredible events. Get them in over their head.
And your father certainly did that. I loved his books. I had started off wanting to be go to medical school, so I was involved in and around hospitals in my early years, and so I loved his books, and I remember when Extreme Measures came out, and I read that with great excitement, and I'm sure he'd be so proud to know that you guys are doing a tour together, because
he would have loved that. You know, unfortunately, he passed away a year and a half ago, so he hasn't been there for most of this for me. He got to see some of my brother's early stuff come out. But for me, you know, I walked into the local bookstore on publication date for The American Mission, my first book. And there on the bookshelves were my book, my brother's book, and my father's book all lined up right alongside each other on the new release shelf.
Oh, wow.
And that was an awesome moment. That was fabulous. And he would have loved that. He would have loved that almost as much as a review I got on Amazon the other day from someone who wrote about, I think it was the American Mission, wrote, yeah, it was okay, but not as good as his dad.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And Dad would have loved that. He would have pretended not to, but he wouldn't really have been able to keep that a secret.
Tell me when the book was made into a movie that starred Hugh Grant and Sarah Jessica Parker. Did you guys go to the premiere?
Extreme Measures. Absolutely. We were living in New York at the time. My wife and I was working at the UN, and they had the premiere in New York. So,
oh wow!
You know, it was right there. And we went to the premiere, and then the release party was at the Rainbow Room at Rockefeller Center with Hugh Grant and Elizabeth Hurley and Sarah Jessica. The whole gang was there. Gene Hackman I don't think he does the releases, but all the other stars were there, and then a bunch of other celebrity types. And boy, I sure would like to do something like that for one of my books. That'd be fun.
Well, I'm sure you will, because first of all, going back to your first book, The American Mission, which itself was so interesting, because it really touched on something that was actually torn from the headlines, Blood Diamonds.
Well, that's right.
How did you come on to that? And I know that you were involved in part of the, like, certifying African diamonds as conflict-free.
Yeah, I worked with a small group of folk to try and find some solution to this, to the problem of blood diamonds, which in a nutshell was that at a time, particularly 15 years ago, there was a lot of concern that the diamond trade was both a reason that was both promoting conflict in Africa and then allowing these conflicts to continue as various rebel groups and paramilitary groups would fight for control of the diamond fields and then use the diamonds to buy guns and to support their insurgencies. And some of these insurgencies were ungodly violent and brutal and doing terrible, terrible things to the people who had the misfortune to live in their areas of control. And so what we were looking for was a way to try and cut these diamonds out of the system, to make them less valuable to the paramilitaries, by establishing a chain of certification, a system by which people buying a diamond at a jewelry store in New York City could know that that diamond hadn't passed through the hands of a paramilitary force and wasn't contributing to violence and bloodshed in Africa. And that eventually grew into what became known as the Kimberley process for certifying African diamonds. And it's not a perfect process, but it's certainly a step forward in that direction, and I think it helped bring that challenge under control, and is the single thing that I have done in my 24 years in diplomacy in which I take the most pride.
Well, it's a great story, and you know, I'm sure that again, this is going to be, I think both of them are going to be films. That's, you know, going to happen, because they're both great stories, and I think ever since, you know, Alfred Hitchcock loved to do that. He loved to put a character into danger. Like, you know,
he was the master of it. Not just a character, but a regular guy.
Always, exactly. And then they're surrounded by all this evil or Machiavellian conspirators, and then he sees how they're going to get out of it. And I think that's always appealed to audiences. And I'm sure that you know, that both of your books will be films, and you'll have the same kind of premiere as your father, and he'll be there.
Yeah, that would make me happy. That is from your mouth to God's ear.
Well, but you know, your brother's going to be right there, running after you, because his books are also just terrific, and I think it's so adorable, really, as a mother of two sons. I think you know, how adorable. I love when they do things together. And they were both musicians, and so they'd play together. And I love that. And so I can imagine what a joy it is.
We did an event together 2 nights ago in Boston. And, you know, there were readers there, but there were also a lot of friends and family because that's where we're from. And so we had a little segment of our event that was called Ask Mom. And people who in the audience who would ask questions that we thought Mom was in a better position to answer than we were, we would defer the question to her, and so she got her moment in the sun.
Oh, that's cute. That's adorable. Well, I hope my boys will keep that in mind. But when they do something, they can have me there too. working full time is full time, and I would imagine that your job is really very demanding.
My job is more than full time. It's time and a half. I work easy 60 hours a week.
And yet you find time to write. When do you do that, Mike?
Yeah, I don't know. and I don't really know how I wrote the last book. I've already finished my third book, The Wolf of Sarajevo, which is set in the Balkans. And I wrote that over the last 10 months when I've been in this current job. It's very intense. I travel, I would say, about 25% of the time. And so I write in airplanes and airport departure lounges and hotel bars. And then I write late at night. I write from, 9 o'clock at night to 11:30 at night. And I drink a lot of coffee.
Well, that's what I work with. I'm writing a book about F-105 pilots. And I get up at 0400 hours and work on it. Because
so did they.
Exactly. And so I always feel sort of a link to them at that time of the morning, but that's the best time for me to write. But it takes a lot.
Why the F-105? Did you have a family member who flew one?
No, I didn't. But what happened is I was asked to write a screenplay about from a book based on from a pilot of a F-105, and from that time on, now in 3 years, I have been so deeply involved in the F-105 community. Working to bring together all of their stories, and I not just pilots, but also the ground crews, who I love, and I get stories from them. They send in the stories. I'm putting them together. I'm writing a mini series, I'm doing a documentary and a mini series about them, because they are such amazing, amazing men. And
is that the Starfighter? Is that what it was called?
No, the Thunder Chief. It was called
Thunder Chief. That's it.
The Thud was the nickname, and the F-105 pilots have been largely forgotten again because of political reasons. It wasn't a popular war, but they were the most amazing pilots. So the F-105 was not an easy plane to fly. It was a supersonic fighter, and a really a big plane, and for one man to handle this plane was not easy, and they had to be really great pilots. And so I've really been dedicating the last 3 years at 0400 hours most mornings, putting together this story, because it is so important, and it's coming up to the 50th anniversary. And so many of them, of course, were killed, and so many became POWs. So that's what I'm doing. I'm doing in my spare time.
Well, I congratulate you on that. That's a fabulous project, and certainly one that's worthy.
Well, I trying to work with veterans to preserve their memories, to preserve these stories for the next generation. And that's why I admire what you're doing, is that you're writing your stories around something that's really important for people to learn about. And I think, reading your book, one never feels like one's getting a history lesson but you learn this stuff as you read. And that's why it's so important that writers, it's like, J.K. Rowling wrote Harry Potter. Well, the kids can't put it down, but at the same time, they're learning a lot, and mm-hmm. So with your books and of course your father's and now your brother's books, it's all this knowledge. And that's why I'm doing everything I can to encourage people to read. And that's one of the reasons I do this program. And I call it Joy on Paper, because it's joy not just for the writers. It's also joy for the readers to read and to just enjoy themselves and at the same time to learn something and be...
That's right. I try not to be didactic about it. But one of the reasons why I like writing about this universe is that my colleagues are interesting, thoughtful people who talk about interesting things. They talk about ideas. They talk about abstractions. They talk about how the world works. And so my characters get to do that too.
You've captured, for me, Bombay. Well, I still call it Bombay. Mumbai.
Yeah, you can't do that. You're going to get in trouble.
I know. I'm going to get it. Well, I have an excuse, though. Beside my other book that I'm working on another book that I write late at night, and this is about the British Raj. And so I know Bombay. I mean, I know every street in Bombay in 1875.
It's changed a lot.
Exactly. But I could walk there and tell you, you know, I walk down the streets and I know Bombay of 1875. So I know they have to forgive me for that, because, you know, when your mind is half the time in 1875, it's hard to come back to.
They may have to, but they won't.
I know. But that's... Yeah, that's still in my mind. But you did capture Mumbai so beautifully, and I just admire it so much. And so the new book that's going to be coming out is about Sarajevo.
It's set in Sarajevo, Sarajevo.
Yes, your pronunciation is perfect.
Threatened. I spent a lot of time in that part of the world, and it reaches a certain point where these pronunciations get stuck in your head, and you can't say it any other way. Sarajevo is perfectly fine. Bosnia in the book is once again under a cloud of war, and somebody or somebodies is manipulating the politics in Bosnia in pursuit of a new war, and somebody who stands to benefit from this. And our hero, Eric Petrosian, is half Cambodian, half Armenian, who lost a friend in the genocide at Srebrenica. So his life has been shaped by three genocides. And that is a theme that I develop at some length in the new book.
Wow, half Armenian. It's your father's character in Extreme Measures was Armenian.
That's right, Nigerian.
Yeah, so you have a connection to Armenia, or
no, not in particular, except that we had some family that lived in Watertown.
But
beyond that, you know, if you write enough books, eventually you're going to run over the same nationality.
That's good. Look, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. It's been wonderful to talk to you. I know that when your new book comes out, I hope you'll come back on.
Of course, I would love to. This has been great fun.
It would be really great. And then by then, I have a feeling you'll have at least one movie deal. And so you can talk about that, too. And we can talk.
That'd be a lovely thing.
And we'll talk about the new book, which is, what's the name of it again?
The Wolf of Sarajevo.
Oh, that's it. That's going to be that's a great title, and I'm looking forward to reading it. So I want to thank you again, and this is, you know, been a pleasure. So bye for now.
Thanks, Betsy. I really appreciate you having me on your show.
Okay, thank you. I know you're on a whirlwind tour now here, so have fun with your brother.
Most grateful.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye. Oh, that was fun. You know, Matthew is his father, Michael Palmer, which we mentioned in earlier, of course, is famous for his fantastic medical mysteries. I remember that when I first read his last week, I interviewed Robin Cook, of course, who wrote Medical Mysteries, and the second author who is acclaimed for his medical mysteries, of course, is Michael Palmer, and he wrote The Silent Treatment and Natural Causes. I think there Extreme Measures, which was, I think, probably one of the best medical mysteries. So if you're into medical mysteries and not squeamish about going into the hospital and worried about what's going to happen to you, both Robin Cook's book, which I read last week and which I really enjoyed, called Host, is now available. And of course, Michael Palmer passed away several years ago, but his books are still available on Amazon, and they are fantastic reads and perfect for an adventure into a real mystery and a real thriller. So I'm really grateful that Matthew came on, and I'm very excited that I've already invited his brother Daniel to come on the program. So I look forward to talking to him too, and I might even get their mother to to come on, because she has a great deal to do with their work, and I know it would be fun for them to have her on the program too. It's been a busy week. Last week I went to the Tampa Bay Festival of Reading, and it was a fantastic event. I was really impressed with the entire program. There were over 60 authors, and everything was so well arranged. And you must, next year, if you didn't attend this year, plan for it in advance. They are going to have even more authors, and they have a fantastic arrangement. Each of the authors are given a wonderful location in which to speak, and then to meet with the readers who get to ask some questions and get to take pictures with them, and of course get signed autographs. And so it's wonderful. It's a wonderful event. And so if you're a reader, make sure that you pay attention next year when I announce the Festival of Reading, which is sponsored by Tampa Bay Times, of course. And if you're reading the Tampa Bay Times, always look out for Colette Bancroft's book reviews. She has a wonderful eye for not only the newest thrillers and newest books that often become bestsellers, partly because of her reviews. So she's really an interesting writer, and I highly recommend that you read her reviews and get reading, because it's so much fun to be able to read a book. Sometimes if you read a book that somebody's reviewed, and then you have your own opinion and can compare your judgment to the reviewer. So it's lots of fun, and I hope that you'll enjoy that. Next, in a few weeks, I have coming up somebody absolutely fantastic, a writer that has really made an impact in the world of thrillers, and that's Sue Grafton. And she's already up to the letter X, so it's very exciting that I'm going to be able to speak to her about her career, about how she plots her books, about everything that she's involved in the all of the development of her varied characters and exciting thrillers. So please join me in 2 weeks. It'll be in 2 weeks when I have Sue Grafton on. I will also be having Elizabeth George is coming up. She has a new book out called The Banquet of Consequences, and it is another in her series of Inspector Lindley books. Very popular, set around Scotland Yard and Inspector Lindley and his partner, Barbara Havers. And if you haven't read the books yet, they are really fascinating. She has been very lucky in that BBC has picked up her books and has been running a series, quite a few years now, of the Inspector Lindley series. And you will, you know, if you haven't read the books, or you've only read seen the television show, you must get the books and catch up with her. And I'm very happy that she's going to be on in a few weeks. And coming up over the next few months, actually, I'm going to be starting a program called Back in Time Interviews. And these are interviews with famous people in history. And I'm very grateful that West Coast Players and some other actors from West Coast Players and some other organizations are going to be helping me to put on these interviews for you. My first one will be of Hemingway, and it's set in 1949, after the war and after his adventures in the war. And one of the most fascinating times in his life, where he was in a sort of a flux of where he was going to go and what he was going to be writing about. So that's going to be coming up in the next few months, and it's exciting to be able to go back in time and learn what the writers were thinking about at the time when they were actually working on their books. And I'm very grateful that this opportunity has arisen, because everyone who enjoys books is always wondering, you know, what were the people like? And so I've done a great deal of research, and everything from the voice, type of voice they had, to the type of food they liked, to, you know, what their reviews were actually at the time when their books came out, because people have been writing book reviews for many, many years, and so it's fascinating when you go back in time and you read the reviews of some of the great writers of today, and find out you know what the people were saying at the time. So it's I hope you're going to enjoy that, the back in time interviews that will be coming up soon. I also have a plan to do a authors forum sometime in the spring, in which I'm going to be inviting a number of authors to get together and to talk about their books. And this will be held up, we'll have this up in Clearwater someplace, because Clearwater is the ideal place for writers. It's so inspiring to be here. We have such beautiful weather and such a wonderful group of excited readers who both listen to this program and who come to events like the Festival of Reading. So please keep in mind that this will be coming up soon. And meanwhile, this is Patsy with a Z, Patsy Gill, wishing you a great week. Please go to my webpage, radio-joyonpaper.com, and you can hear the archived interviews that I have on there, everything from Robin Cook to Brad Meltzer, and all sorts of authors, including our poet laureate. So I want to thank Big Ed in the control room, and remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken on stage or screen. So join me next Tuesday at 11 a.m. for Joy on Paper. Me.